It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. You are under surveillance in some form every minute of your life. This is the day and age in which we live. Surveillance technology is overwhelming, and most of us, well, we hardly understand it. My guest this half hour will help us understand how surveillance plays a role in our everyday lives and what we know about it, most people know about it, and don't know about these technologies. Guy McKendry is Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. He teaches a course on surveillance culture in addition to his research. He joins us today by Skype. Hello, Guy.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for being on. Your research in reading about it is tremendously important, interesting, all of the above. Let's start with setting sort of a baseline for those of us who aren't fully aware. I count myself in there too. Give us a picture of how each of us are surveilled in our everyday lives, the length and the breadth of it.
Yeah. So I would say surveillance in our everyday lives starts with our smartphone. Most people today in the United States and around the world carry a smartphone with them at all times. And that device is like a little spy in your pocket because it is location aware, so it knows where you are. It is constantly sending and receiving data that can give away your location, your browsing habits, what apps you use. And so even when you're sleeping and it's resting there on your nightstand, collecting notifications for the morning, it is aware of where you are and can even indicate that you're sleeping because of your lack of movement or activity. So there's a lot of data there that just comes from the phone itself. But of course, our smartphones aren't the limit of surveillance today. We all use credit cards, and all the data from our bank transactions, our credit and debit charges, all of that's collected by our credit score companies, as we know. They're often connected to databases with our phone numbers and email addresses to track purchases. That's connected to income information. So our consumer behavior is under a fair amount of surveillance as well. And then kind of one more example I would give is government surveillance, and not just kind of like the like Big Brother tapping our phone kind of connotations, but vast networks of CCTV cameras and license plate readers that can track who's coming and going on a public road. Now we're starting to see facial recognition systems put out by the government. And so there are all these facets of our life where we are under surveillance day and night.
Mm-hmm. You talk about our cell phone being a spy in our pocket. It's a spy we willingly have in our pocket because we gain such tremendous benefits from it, right? Right, Guy? This is, we know there's a trade-off, but are you saying we don't know, in the cell phone's case, we don't know the extent of that trade-off, what we're giving away for all the convenience that we get?
Yeah. And so I don't want to imply at all that I think that smartphones are this evil thing that no one should have. I bought the first iPhone when I was in college because I was obsessed. I love my smartphone. What worries me is that all of the capabilities of a smartphone are not always transparent to the user. So sometimes apps ask for permissions that they don't need, and we're so used to clicking yes that we don't really understand the full reach of them into our lives, or the settings that you need to protect your privacy and not collect or pool all that data together are not always transparent. And even in some cases, there are some devices that come with baked in, it's hard to call it anything other than malware, that is giving your information away, and you don't have control over that. So it's not, this is the hardest thing about talking about surveillance technology. I wish I could make it like good versus evil, always good, always bad, but it just lives in this gray area. And the smartphone is the perfect example of that.
Mm-hmm. And when you talk about law enforcement or government law enforcement, even companies, we can see that as well-meaning in a way, more the government end of it, law enforcement. You want the laws to be obeyed, and this is a way to do it. companies, I guess, are saying what? They're saying, hey, we know you better as a consumer. We can tailor our ads to you. And this is a good thing, right? I mean, this is the argument I hear.
Yeah, so I think in these instances, you ask, what is the purpose of the data being collected and who does that help or empower? Obviously, some of that use of data collection is to make algorithms more accurate, right? Target you with ads that are going to be more relevant. Or if we think about just Google search, which tailors search results to the individual user whenever possible. Yeah, I mean, there's a reason why I choose Google over some other search engines. It's usually because it produces more relevant results for me. The issue that I think I start struggling with is when that benefit moves beyond my individual need. And so my data is being extracted or used for other purposes, or it's being sold to third parties or other entities. So an example of that is, I believe when Sports Authority declared bankruptcy, the biggest asset that they held was their customer data. And that was sold to a competitor. They bought that so they could incorporate that data and improve their own sales. And for me, that goes a step beyond what the average consumer should expect. Mm-hmm. So that concerns me. And then also transparency. I mean, yeah, I believe in a lot of ways law enforcement is employing surveillance with the best interests of the community at heart. But that doesn't mean that the technology they're using is equitable across all citizens within their city, or that it gives them power that is within kind of constitutional limits. So the technology is advancing kind of faster than the laws can catch up.
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Guy McKendry is my guest, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Creighton University in Omaha. He's done some fascinating research. We're going to talk about that in just a moment, but he also teaches a course on surveillance culture. So we're talking with him today about our interactions with surveillance technology, how overwhelming it is, and how we hardly understand how we are being surveilled. Let's get to that research, Guy. Tell us about your newest research. There's some interesting facets there.
Yeah, thanks. So the project that I'm starting is a book-length look at our culture of surveillance today. And what I mean by that is the ways that as a society we have accepted and incorporated surveillance into our everyday life. And then also points or flashpoints where we say, no, that's a step too far, and we try and resist the incorporation of surveillance technology. And this is based on kind of a lot of research I've done in the past. A lot of what I study focused on the TSA, Transportation Security Administration. So I looked at airport security as a specific example of the government instituting new norms and practices of surveillance in airports after 9/11. And then I've also done just a variety of other smaller projects. Most recently, I took a look at parental surveillance, and I looked at how science fiction dystopian shows like Black Mirror actually, rather than being some far off scary thing in the future to warn us about, is pretty close to the reality we have here, and asking questions about how parents surveil their children was really interesting for me, because at that time, my wife and I were expecting, and it was right before our first child was born, so we were starting to have these conversations as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm a big fan of Black Mirror. I know some people really don't like it because it just makes them feel awful about our present and our future. Do you have a specific episode that you can talk about that makes the point you just did?
Absolutely. So the episode that I kind of use to talk about parental surveillance is called Archangel. And it's an episode where this mother is so worried and panicked about the safety of her daughter that she enrolls the daughter in this trial from a new company called Archangel, and they put this little implant in the child's brain, and it gives the mom real-time biometric access so it can see heartbeat. It is scanning her blood, so if she takes an illicit substance, that shows up as well. And I think the freakiest part in the episode is she also gets to see what her daughter is seeing in real time. And sorry for the spoiler, but it leads to a very awkward encounter where the mom ends up seeing her daughter's first sexual encounter.
Yeah.
And it's uncomfortable.
Oh, I remember it. And yes, it just gives you the complete creeps about our current and future surveillance culture there. Let's talk about some of the other facets of your research. Parental surveillance, you say that practices used in collecting these vast amounts of data about each of us are frequently biased. Biased how? In what way?
Yeah, so whenever a company or the government rolls out some kind of automated surveillance system, and I think about this a lot with facial recognition, they are using these models where they've taken some data from other users, used a process to help it make predictions. And oftentimes that initial learning data set is incomplete or is not representative of the larger population. So with facial recognition technology, for example, there is, when someone creates a program using facial recognition, they start with a database of just a ton of photos, mm-hmm. and they're training it to recognize matches and similarities. But if that training data, for example, has a smaller number of photos of African-American men, then the quality and accuracy of that facial recognition system in matching and predicting African-American men is lower. And so there's this higher probability of false positives. And then when you sell that tool to law enforcement, you roll it out in some other public use, then you have this system that could flag individuals who have done nothing wrong, and they have no access or control to that. A second example that I think also makes this point pretty well is those whole body imagers at the airport that everybody loves. They work off this template of what they think a normal male or female body would look like. And so anyone that doesn't match that template, either because they're bigger than the template, if they are trans, if they have a disability and have metal in their body, then they all get selected for additional screening simply because they don't meet this kind of template that the company that designed the system said, this is what a person should look like.
Wow, fascinating. Yeah, everybody can relate. Most people can relate to that airport example of, you know, raising your arms, putting your legs apart, raising your arms. And then, I don't know about you, Guy, but I look at the people looking at me and I'm like, wow, what a job, right?
Yep.
And to do that all day. And, you know, it's a part of ensuring our security on flights in this day and age. You also highlight a bias posing potential dangers to women, especially. Explain.
Yeah. So one of the most difficult things that comes up in my research is the degree to which the incorporation of surveillance devices, technology practices into our everyday life is the way that it has normalized kind of expansive data sharing with romantic partners, for example. And so when I talk to students, they talk about sharing their location at all times with their boyfriend or girlfriend. They talk about having joint accounts or sharing passwords, things like that. And while when you're in a very happy and healthy relationship, that can seem like a good idea, there is also this kind of shadow economy of apps, devices that can help facilitate stalking or abusive relationships. And so what some research that people have done have shown, for example, is an incredible uptick in women who are at shelters because they are suffering from intimate partner violence, they're in abusive relationships, mm-hmm. and they're seeing more and more technology used in helping to facilitate that abuse or stalking. Because in the United States and elsewhere as well, we see women as disproportionately being targeted for abuse and stalking, it means that these technologies are unfairly used to target women, which is not to say that men don't experience it. They do. But when you start looking at the numbers and the difference in power, it really does harm women in a very serious way.
I'm just thinking about what you said about sharing location in a relationship. You start a relationship, everything's rosy, you're happy, and you kind of decide, oh, let's share each other's location all the time. It's kind of fun to keep track of each other. It's also a sign of trust, right? And then the relationship starts to deteriorate, and you really can't step back from sharing your location without, what, showing distrust, right?
Yeah, and it creates this double bind that that we talk about a lot, my colleagues do, who study interpersonal communication. And as that relationship breaks down, someone is pulling back. So you restrict access to that location. And then that becomes a signal to the other person, oh, they're pulling back. Mm-hmm. And then they might start to kind of reach out or be more aggressive, or they withdraw. And so it's hard to kind of close that door once you've opened it.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Guy McKendry, is at Creighton University in Nebraska, teaches a course on surveillance culture. Also does a lot of research, as you've heard here. Guy, tell us about some other things you've seen in the news that are really on the cusp, on the cutting edge of really questionable surveillance.
Yeah, so there in the news recently, there's been a lot of controversy around a company called Clearview AI. And they have built this kind of massive facial recognition database, which is just kind of orders of magnitude larger than what we've seen deployed publicly before by law enforcement. And they've indicated that they have worked with law enforcement. And part of the reason why this is controversial is because they have just scraped images off of the web, off of Facebook and Twitter.
Yours, and Google, mine?
Potentially. We don't know the source of all of their images or who is included. And so that's opening a lot of legal issues around copyright. Did they have, you know, permission to use those images when you signed them over to Facebook to display them? Is that within the terms? Their CEO recently proclaimed a First Amendment right to all the images that are publicly available on the internet. I'm pretty dubious about that claim, but we'll see how it plays out. So that for me is just really frightening, mm-hmm. because it emphasizes how little control the average consumer or individual has over their information once it's online.
Mm-hmm. In the second half hour, when we'll take a break in a few minutes and come back with sort of proactive measures, I know you can talk about that, about what we should be doing, what we can be doing in our surveillance culture here. But first of all, I want to sort of try out, and I'm sure I am far from the only person doing this. I love the convenience of all these, you know, our smartphones, as you do, and all this new technology. And I comfort myself by saying, hey, I'm an everyday person living an everyday life. I'm not doing anything criminal. Why should I be worried? So answer that question.
Yeah, so this is one of the most common objections to a critical take at surveillance. And I think it's really good to reframe this, because we think, oh, I'm not doing anything wrong. Nobody cares about me. And kind of two responses that I always give. One, you better believe people care about you and they will use your information, even if they think it's in your best interest, to push and pull you in certain directions. So when a company is using targeted ads, they're trying to limit your view of what options you have as a consumer to increase the likelihood that you will choose their product. And so the more data that you give, the more ability they have to target you pretty directly. And that limits your choice as a consumer because other options just disappear for you. And so that's, I think, an area of concern. And then the second thing that I often will tell students is, look, what counts as doing something wrong changes over time and changes with context. So I think a lot about when DACA was rolled out in the Obama administration, one of the things the Dreamers agreed to do in response was to give over a lot of information to the government about where they're living, employment, and that personal information at the time was safe to hand over because they're not doing anything wrong. But now that the current administration is looking at revoking DACA and beginning to talk about removing the Dreamers, that information that they shared now could be used against them. And so that change in what we think of as right or wrong doesn't care if at the time you thought you were doing the right thing when you agreed to extra monitoring or surveillance.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so that's why we should. So it's interesting that you say, you know, companies would say, hey, we're using this information to tailor your consumer experience. But you say the operative word should be limiting. We should change that, not just adopt what they tell us.
Yeah, because they have a financial stake, right? So the vast majority of Google's ad revenue or of Google's revenue as a corporation comes from advertising. And so they're in the business of directing us to specific products and services that serve their bottom line, which means they have a disincentive to show us things that might be competitors. And, sometimes I think many of us have that moment where that targeted ad is just too specific that it feels a little creepy. Mm. I remember for a while getting a targeted ad for dog-friendly vacations in Wisconsin. And I have in-laws in Wisconsin. I travel there multiple times a year. I'm an avid dog lover, advocate for dog rescue. But I was sitting there mowing my lawn, listening to Spotify, and that ad popped up, and it was kind of like, okay, that's too far. That's too much.
Right, but we get used to it. Hey, guy, we adapt. We're humans. We adapt, right? And we get used to things that may initially seem creepy, but then with time seem less creepy for some reason. Guy McKendry is with me. We have to take a break. This is a fascinating conversation. Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Creighton University in Omaha, and talking about some of his research. I want to ask you when we come back, Guy, about some of the experiments you do, studies, or work you do with your students in class, and also the measures that we can take to avoid being tracked by this surveillance technology. When we come back, Guy McKendry, more on his new surveillance research and our surveillance culture. We'll be back in just a moment. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Fascinating discussion today about our surveillance culture. It turns out we are under surveillance in some form every minute of our lives, and a lot of it we just don't understand what it's used for why it's done and what we can do about it. We want to talk about that this hour with Guy McKendry of Creighton University in Omaha. He teaches a course on surveillance culture in addition to his research on it. Guy, we talked a lot about your research last half hour. Let me talk ask you a little bit about your class on surveillance culture. You do surveys with your students, and these are Gen Zs. These are students in their early 20s, right?
Yes.
Tell us how you use them, how you work with them to, and you enlighten them. They are digital natives, but I guess you can surprise them as well.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things that you learn very quickly when you teach students this age is that there's this narrative of them as digital natives and they're just great with computers. And that's not really what I find is the case. And I don't mean that in a bad thing. It is, they are very good with the systems and apps that they have used, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're these whizzes at everything. And so I actually like that because I can identify with them when I have my own failures with technology. But what I like to do is find ways in class for them to see specifically how they experience surveillance. And rather than it being this kind of ominous, overarching term, or in class, a lot of times we're talking about the history of surveillance, which can date back to ancient Egypt. I want them to see how it's applicable to how they live their lives. And so there are a couple different things I do, but one of the most effective is I ask them for 36 hours to keep a log and write down every time they interact with a surveillance system. So that can be walking in a store past a CCTV camera. That can be playing on their phone or browsing the internet. And so their data is being tracked and extracted from their phone. Or, you know, when they're in class with me, we're having discussions. I'm walking around taking notes on who's saying what. And that's a form of surveillance as well.
And so when you ask them to do that for 36 hours, are they, first of all, able to do that? That would be sort of almost an overwhelming task, or it would consume a bit of your day to track that.
It's a lot of work, and they remind me of that playfully at times. So it's difficult for them to get everything, but they really do their best. And one of the things I love is they just jump in and are so smart and genuine, and they really want to know how much do they experience this. And so they do engage, and they are, you know, sometimes they do a little shorthand, like, slept for 4 hours, my phone was near me, so there was location tracking going on. But also they write down every time they see a camera, or if they're driving and there's a police officer that passes them, they record that as well. And it produces, you know, sometimes pages and pages of experiences that they've had.
And so in what ways are some of your students' eyes opened using this technology as digital natives, but perhaps not being aware of how invasive, how intrusive it is?
Yeah, so one of the first things that they talk about is when they realize just how many things are trying to track them on the web. So I've had a couple students in the past who have used different techniques for seeing how many, like how websites are using trackers and pulling or exploiting their data. And so when they do that as part of this log, they kind of go, all right, that's too much, and I'm really uncomfortable with that. And so they'll start using an ad blocker some of the time to help safeguard some of their data. Others will change some of their routes, the way they drive or travel to or from campus, to try and avoid some of that surveillance, or just to break up their routine so it isn't so constant. And I've had a student in the past have some pretty difficult conversations with their parents about whether or not, you know, the parents should be tracking their every move on their cell phone, given that they're now out of the house, in college, and an adult. And that's a really productive conversation to have.
Well, that's interesting, because my kids are all adult kids now, and I guess I don't know what is the usual thing as kids, you know, are in elementary school, they get into their teens and beyond. You know, certainly we can understand parents tracking elementary kids, and it starts to get grayer in junior high, and then it gets completely objectionable as far as the high schooler is concerned with that's continuing on into high school. How is that negotiated?
So one of the things that always concerns me is when any surveillance system is used without consent. So when I write about parental surveillance, one of the things I think about is, when should parents make the ethical choice to engage in and have a conversation with their children about the ways that they are being tracked? And there's not a one-size-fits-all answer, nor is it like one moment in time. But I do think parents should be open about what they are or are not doing with their children, and be open to feedback and response, and also not just get sucked into that trap, right? Well, I've been doing it since elementary school, so I guess it's fine to do when they get to college.
Right, because I can imagine at late elementary or early junior high, depending on the child, that child will put his or her foot down and say, no more of this. when do you start listening to this, no more of this?
Yeah, I mean, when I think about, and I say that I have an 11-month-old, so I'm a long way from this conversation. And so I want to be careful, you know, that Nora isn't able to find this and play a clip back to me in 10 or 12 years. But for me, I think it is really important that you give a child the chance to make a choice and to have some options. That way they're included in the conversation. And also, you know, I think one of the goals of any parent is to foster, develop, and raise a child who is independent, capable of making good decisions, and being an ethical actor in the world. And so part of helping create and foster that independence does involve eventually letting go of your parental control and mm-hmm. letting them make decisions for themselves. And so it's important to think about, what is the message I'm sending to my child if I have these kind of oppressive parental surveillance in use? What am I saying to them about how I think of them and their abilities?
Mm-hmm. If you just joined us, Guy McHenry is my guest. He's a professor of communication, associate professor of communication studies at Creighton University in Omaha. And he's talking about his research on surveillance culture. They're talking about his work in the classroom as he teaches a course on surveillance culture. Well, let's get to the part here, Guy, when we can be proactive, when we can feel better about our world. I'm hoping you can do that, Guy. We'll see. How can we avoid being unnecessarily tracked by this surveillance technology? What are the proactive measures we can take?
Yeah, so the topic is so big and there's so many ways we're tracked that it can feel hopeless. And I actually warned students on the first day of class that, you know, this class might make you a little paranoid. And if it doesn't, then I failed. And so I try and end the class with giving students specific strategies that they can use to help safeguard their identity and their data. And the biggest thing is, you know, I do not believe that it is possible for us in society today to just opt out and avoid all forms of surveillance. And so what I start with students asking them to do is to look at the places in their life where they are most vulnerable, where they face the biggest risks if they're surveilled. Is that on their phone? Is that in their relationship? Is that through some other surveillance approach? And so once you identify the place where you are most at risk, then you can think about what are specific actions to take. That said, there are a couple things that everybody should do no matter what, please. Mm. One of those is use unique passwords as much as possible across all the websites and accounts that you have, rather than having kind of one master password for everything.
Oh, yeah.
Because
just to jump in here, passwords just bedevil us, don't they? Because if you do what you're suggesting, you have to think of a new darn password for 10, 20, 30, 40 different things. That's just a lot of work.
It is a lot of work. And it is not helpful that a good secure password is very difficult to remember. So I always recommend that people look into a password manager. So these are third parties who are able to help you store and create and input passwords on whatever device you're using. And that can be really helpful for keeping track of kind of that hornet's nest of passwords that you're using.
Right, right. But explain this a little bit, because you give one, that you have one of these services, you have one password and it unlocks 20 passwords. So what if someone figures out that one password?
So first of all, don't make that one password your kind of most used or favorite password. Also, there are kind of security measures in place, usually on those websites, that require two-factor authentication. That's when you give a password and then also you get a code texted to you, or some other kind of security key to protect that account. The reality is, though, that password could be compromised. And so there is some good hygiene that you can do, changing it regularly, keeping track. There's a website called Have I Been Pwned, which will let you input your email address, and it'll tell you whether or not that email is associated with lists or archives of passwords that have been bought or sold online.
As you say, this is so expansive technology. We can't possibly get to all these areas. I wanted to ask you about one that has, you know, come into our houses in recent years. Some people are especially wary of smart speakers. I know families are divided about whether smart speakers and smart technology to, you know, not only music, but turn off lights with a voice or a hand clap should even be allowed in the house. Does smart technology like this pose a bigger threat? Or, you know, given that our TVs, our smart TVs and our cell phones can be hacked to spy on us, perhaps even more effectively, what's all this attention about smart speakers? Is that warranted? Do you have smart technology in your house, Guy?
I have some smart technology. I do not have any smart speakers. I try and draw the line at anything with a built-in camera or microphone that I cannot turn on or turn off myself. But again, my wife likes to call me paranoid, so maybe I am. The controversy with these speakers really stems from the fact that for them to work properly and respond to voice input, it means that at some level, there has to be a microphone listening at all times for you to say whatever the wake word is. Mm-hmm. So whether, you know, you're using Siri or Alexa or whatever, there's that microphone is active. And both Amazon and Apple have faced kind of intense criticism because of those recordings and thinking about how they're being used. Are people hearing those recordings, or is it just some algorithmic system? And the reality is that, yeah, these companies pay third-party contractors, people, to listen to those snippets of audio to help improve the systems. And so you have to ask yourself, am I comfortable with this window into, or this microphone into, my private life potentially being used and heard by third parties? Mm-hmm. And for me, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm. Okay. There is that button on some of these smart speakers where you can turn its ears off, so to speak.
Yes, absolutely.
Which is a compromise I actually make. So there. is there other technology, or maybe you didn't put that in this class, but just technology you would say you should just flat out avoid because of its surveillance threat?
So one of the things that I would, so speaking for me personally, I would avoid is any kind of internet-connected or smart video camera inside your home. I understand why people really think Amazon Ring, their kind of video doorbell system, is useful, why they might use it outside of their house, though I still have ethical qualms there about, you know, you recording people in public without them knowing. But inside the home, I really just worry about those kind of smart connected cameras. And there has been a lot of news recently about Amazon Ring being hacked. That's not new. Amazon isn't the only one who has had people access those cameras inside someone's home without permission. There are a lot of off-the-shelf camera systems that people use as baby monitors or to monitor their bedrooms and hallways and living rooms that have really poor security. And there are, unfortunately, places on the web that index open cameras in people's homes, so you can just pop around and see inside someone's house. And to me, that's just so stomach churning. Mm-hmm. That I would recommend against that to someone.
Mm-hmm. Driverless cars are here. Very, very yes. small instances of that. I don't think I've seen one yet, but maybe you have. So they will be here in a matter of years, and they will become a minority and then maybe a majority of the vehicles on our roads. What are your concerns there?
So a driverless car is little more than like a rolling surveillance juggernaut, right? Because it has to collect all this data in real time and use it to make decisions. And I understand the appeal of driverless cars. As someone who from time to time has been accused by loved ones of not being the best driver, I can see why there's some desire with having these automated systems that people believe might be safer than a human driver. But just like with some of the inaccuracies around facial recognition, the decisions that these cars make actually have some really complicated ethical issues. Do they, for example, favor or privilege the life of the driver or other people in the case of an imminent accident?
Someone's going to get hurt, and a computer decides who and how many.
Yes. So the algorithm has to decide, right? What do I do in the face of this imminent accident? And if I have a few split second options that are faster than a human driver could react, do I do something that protects my driver at all costs? Or do I do something that might maximize the survivability for everyone at some risk to the driver? That's a really difficult ethical question.
Mm. We have just a couple minutes, 2 or 3 minutes left, Guy. I wanted to make sure I asked you about, you know, laws, current laws, laws that you would say need to be put into place to better protect us from surveillance. And also, you know, do other countries, in terms of laws protecting the citizenry, do a better job than we do?
Yeah, so this technology is developing at such a rapid pace that it's actually been really difficult to legislate how to control an individual's private data. Generally, I would say the European Union is an example of a place where the legal framework has tried to adapt to protect the consumer, even at the expense of larger corporations. In the United States, our kind of prevailing dominant social attitudes are really wary of any kind of regulation. And so this larger belief of the markets will settle it, corporations will only act in their best interests, has meant we have not done enough to pass any kind of meaningful regulation to protect consumers. Now, that is starting to change some on the local level. So with all of the controversy of late around facial recognition, there are some smaller municipalities that have begun passing bans on the use of facial recognition because of its potential threats to privacy and bias. And so that's one thing that I think is a really important conversation to start having. What are the boundaries for how facial recognition should be used and rolled out within the United States? When can we use it? When can't we? And once the technology is out there, people aren't going to decide on their own to pull back. So this is a place where some government action is warranted.
Mm-hmm. Okay. In the remaining minute or two here, tell us briefly about what you have in store for your next research. Or what are the questions on your mind you'd like to study and get answers to?
Yeah, so beginning this summer and throughout the fall, I'll be working on a book-length project on surveillance culture. And I'm kind of guided by some of the ethical conundrums and questions that my students have really inspired in our discussions. And so I'm looking to do a kind of broad survey of surveillance culture today, studying and analyzing, for example, how the news media, mass media, portrays surveillance in their coverage of new developments, new technologies, or controversies around a particular surveillance device. And then also looking at how companies pitch their surveillance devices to the public. Mm-hmm. What arguments are they trying to make to a consumer to try and persuade them to buy this gadget? or this app.
Guy, fascinating. We've run out of time. We'll have to talk again. This has been such an interesting hour. Guy McHenry, Associate Professor of Communication Studies at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska. We hope to have you back on the program again to talk about your continued research in this fascinating area of surveillance. Guy, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Guy McHenry joining us via Skype. River to River is produced by Rick Brewer, Caitlin Harrop, and Matt Alvarez. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.